You'll never see the stars again. Unless I get the resistance. What they want. A light flares in the Commandant's study, and I start, surprised she's still awake. Her curtains flutter, and voices drift down through the open window. She's not alone. Tullamon's words come back to me. I never saw your brother afraid. He never seemed to focus on what could turn out wrong. He only ever thought about how things could turn out right. A worn trellis runs up alongside the Commandant's window, covered in summer-dead vines. I give the trellis a shake. It's rickety, but not unclimbable. She's probably not saying anything useful anyway. She's probably talking to a student. But why would she meet a student at midnight? Why not during the day? She'll whip you, my fear pleads with me. She'll take an eye, a hand. But I've been whipped and beaten and strangled, and I've survived. I've been carved up with a hot knife, and I've survived. Darin didn't let fear control him. If I want to save him, I can't let fear control me either. Knowing my courage will diminish the longer I think about it, I grab the trellis and climb. Keenan's advice pops into my head. Always have an exit plan. I grimace. Too late for that now. Every scrape of my sandals sounds to me like a detonation. A loud creak makes my heart stutter. But after a minute of paralysis, I realize the sound is just the trellis groaning under my weight. When I reach the top, I still can't hear the Commandant. The windowsill is a foot to my left. 3 feet below the sill, a section of stone has crumbled, leaving a small foothold. I take a breath, grab the sill, and swing from the trellis to the window. My feet scrape against the sheer wall for a terrifying moment before I find the foothold. Don't collapse, I beg the stone beneath my feet. Don't break. My chest wound has opened again, and I try to ignore the blood dripping down my front. My head is even with the Commandant's window. If she leans out, I'm dead. Forget that, Darin tells me. Listen. The clipped tones of the Commandant's voice float through the window, and I lean forward. Be arriving with his entire retinue, my Lord Nightbringer. Everyone, his counselors, the Bloodshrike, the Black Guard, as well as most of Jen's Tyre. The subdued nature of the Commandant's voice is a revelation. Make sure of it, Kerris. Tyres must arrive after the third trial, or our plan is for naught. At the sound of the second voice, I gasp and nearly fall. The voice is deep and soft, not a sound so much as a feeling. It is storm and wind and leaves twisting in the night. It is roots sucking deep at the earth and the pale, sightless creatures that live below the ground. But there's something wrong with this voice, something diseased at its core. Though I've never heard the voice before, I find myself trembling, tempted for a second to drop to the ground just to get away from it. Liar, I hear Darin. Be brave. I risk a peek through the curtains and catch a glimpse of a figure standing in the corner of the room, swathed in darkness. He looks to be nothing more than a medium-sized man in a cloak. But I know in my bones that this is no normal man. Shadows pool near his feet, writhing as if trying to get the figure's attention. Ghouls. When the thing turns toward the Commandant, I flinch, for the darkness beneath his hood has no place in the human world. His eyes glow, slitted suns filled with ancient malevolence. The figure moves, and I jerk away from the window. The Nightbringer, my mind screams. She called him the Nightbringer. We have a different problem, my lord, the Commandant says. The augurs suspect my interference. My instruments are not as subtle as I'd hoped. Let them suspect, the creature says, as long as you shield your mind and we continue teaching the Faraz to shield theirs. The augurs will remain ignorant, though I do wonder if you've chosen the right aspirants, Kerris. They've just botched a second ambush, though I told them everything they needed to end Aquila and Veturius. The Faraz are the only choice. Veturius is too stubborn, and Aquila too loyal to him. Then Marcus must win, and I must be able to control him, the Shadow Man says. Even if it is one of the others, the Commandant's voice is filled with a doubt I never imagined her capable of expressing. Veturius, for instance. You can kill him and take his form. Changing form is no easy task. And I am not an assassin, Commandant, to be used to kill off those who are thorns in your side. He's no thorn. If you want your son dead, do it yourself. But do not let it interfere with the task I have given you. If you cannot perform that task, our partnership is at an end. Two trials remain, my Lord Nightbringer. The Commandant's voice is low with suppressed rage. As both will take place here, I am sure I can. You have little time. 13 days is plenty. And if your attempts at sabotaging the trial of strength fail, the fourth trial is only a day later. In 2 weeks, Kerris, you will have a new emperor. See that it's the right one. I will not fail you, my lord. Of course not, Kerris. You've never failed me before. As a token of my faith in you, I've brought you another gift. A rustle, a rip, and then a sharp intake of breath. Something to add to that tattoo, the Commandant's guest says. Shall I? No, the Commandant breathes. No, this one's mine. As you will. Come, see me to the gate. Seconds later, the window slams shut, nearly jarring me from my perch, and the lamps go out. I hear the distant thud of the door, and all falls silent. My whole body shakes. Finally, I have something useful for the Resistance. It's not everything they want to know, but it might be enough to sate Mazin to buy more time. Half of me is jubilant, but the other half is still thinking about the creature the Commandant called the Nightbringer. What was that thing? Scholars do not, on principle, believe in the supernatural. Skepticism is one of the few remnants of our bookish past, and most of us hold on to it tenaciously. Jinn, ifrits, ghouls, wraiths, they belong in tribal myth and legend. Shadows coming alive are a trick of the eye. A shadow man with a voice out of hell. There should be an explanation for him, too. Except there is no explanation. He is real, just like the ghouls are real. A sudden wind sweeps in from the desert, shaking the trellis and threatening to rip me from my perch. Whatever that thing is, I decide. The less I know about it, the better. All that matters is that I've gotten the information I need. I reach my foot out to the trellis, but pull it back quickly when another gust of wind whips past. The trellis creaks, tips, and before my horrified eyes, drops with a deafening clatter to the flagstones. Bleeding hells, I wince, waiting for Cook or Izzy to come out and discover me. Seconds later, sandals rasp on the courtyard stone. Izzy emerges from the servant's hallway, a shawl wrapped tight around her shoulders. She looks down at the trellis and then up at the window. When she spots me, her mouth is an O of surprise, but she simply lifts the trellis and watches as I climb down. When I turn to face her, I'm hastily composing a fleet of explanations, none of which make any sense. But she speaks first. I want you to know that I think what you're doing is brave. Really brave. Her words come out in a torrent, as if she's been hoarding them all for this moment. I know about the raid and your family and the resistance. I wasn't spying on you, I swear it. It's just, after I took up the sand this morning, I realized I left the irons in the oven to heat. When I came back to get them, you and Cook were talking, and I didn't want to interrupt. Anyway, I was thinking I could help you. I know things, lots of things. I've been at Blackcliff forever. For a second, I'm speechless. Do I beg her not to tell anyone else? Do I get unfairly angry at her for eavesdropping? Do I just stare because I didn't think she had that many words in her? I have no idea, but I do know one thing. I can't accept her help. It's too risky. Before I've said anything, she stuffs her hands under her shawl and shakes her head. Never mind. She looks so lonely, a loneliness of years, of a whole life. It was a stupid idea. Sorry. It's not stupid, I say. Just dangerous. I don't want you getting hurt. If the Commandant finds out, she'll kill us both. Might be better than how things are now. At least I'll die having done something useful. I can't let you, Izzy. My rejection hurts her, and I feel terrible for it, but I'm not so desperate that I'll put her life at risk. I'm sorry. Right. She's back in her shell now. Never mind. Just forget it. I've made the right decision. I know it. But as Izzy walks away, lonely and miserable, I hate the fact that it's me who has made her feel that way. Though I beg Cook to let me run errands for her so I can be out in the markets every day, I hear nothing from the resistance. Until finally, on the third day after overhearing the Commandant, I'm shoving my way past the crowds in the courier's office, and a hand lands on my waist. I instinctively jab back with my elbow to knock the wind out of the fool who thinks he can take liberties. Another hand catches my arm. Lawyer, a low voice murmurs into my ear. Keenan's voice. My skin thrills at the familiar scent of him. He lets my arm go, but his hand tightens on my waist. I'm tempted to push him away and tell him off for touching me, but at the same time, the feel of his hand sends a jolt up my spine. Don't turn, he says. Commandant's put a tail on you. He's trying to work his way through the crowd. We can't risk a meeting now. Do you have anything for us? I raise the Commandant's letter to my face and fan myself, hoping the movement will conceal the fact that I'm talking. I do. I'm practically vibrating with excitement, but I sense only tension from Keenan. When I turn to look at him, he gives me a sharp squeeze of warning, but not before I see the grim cast of his face. My elation fades. Something is wrong. Is Darren okay? I whisper. Is he? I can't say the words. My fear stifles me into silence. He's in a death cell, here in Sarah. In Central Prison. Keenan speaks softly, the way Pop used to when he gave patients the worst news. He's to be executed. All the air drains from my lungs. I can't hear the office clerks yelling, or feel the hands pushing me, or smell the sweat of the crowd. Executed. Killed. Dead. Darren will be dead. We still have time. To my surprise, Keenan sounds sincere. My parents are dead too, he said when I saw him last. My whole family, actually. He understands what Darin's execution will do to me. Perhaps he's the only one who does. The execution will happen after the new emperor is named. That might not be for a while yet. Wrong, I think. In 2 weeks, the Shadow Man had said, you will have a new emperor. My brother doesn't have a while. He has 2 weeks. I need to tell Keenan this, but when I turn to do so, I see a legionnaire standing in the entryway of the courier's office, watching me. The tail. Mazin won't be in the city tomorrow. Keenan bends down, as if he's dropped something on the floor. Keenly aware of the commandant's man, I continue looking straight ahead. But the next day, if you can get out and lose the tail. No, I mutter, fanning myself again. Tonight. I'll get out again tonight, when she's sleeping. She never leaves her room before dawn. I'll sneak out. I'll find you. Too many patrols out tonight. It's the Moon Festival. The patrols will be focused on groups of revelers, I say. They won't notice one slave girl. Please, Keenan. I have to talk to Mazin. I have information. If I can get it to him, he can get Darin out before he's executed. Fine. Keenan looks casually toward the tail. Make your way to the festival. I'll find you there. A moment later, he's gone. I deliver my letter to the courier's desk and pay the fee. Seconds later, I'm outside, watching market-goers rush by. Will the information I have be enough to save my brother? Will it be enough to convince Mazin that he should spring Darin now instead of later? It will be, I decide. It must be. I haven't come this far to watch my brother die. Tonight, I'll convince Mazin to get Darin out. I'll vow to stay a slave until I have the information he wants. I'll promise myself to the resistance. I'll do whatever it takes. But first things first, how am I going to sneak out of Blackcliff?
Chapter 24 Elias. The singing is a river that winds through my pain-infused dreams, quiet and sweet, drawing out memories of a life I've nearly forgotten. A life before Blackcliff. The silk-draped caravan trundling through the tribal desert. My playfellows running riot in the oasis, their laughter ringing like bells. Walking in the shade of the date trees with Mamie Reela, her voice as steady as the hum of life in the desert around us. But when the singing stops, the dreams fade, and I descend into nightmares. The nightmares transform into a black pit of pain, and the pain stalks me like a vengeful twin. A door of clutching darkness opens behind me, and a hand snatches at my back, trying to drag me through. Then the singing begins again, a thread of life in the infinite black, and I reach for it and hold on as tight as I can. I come to consciousness light-headed, as if I've returned to my body after long years away. Though I expect soreness, my limbs move easily, and I sit up. Outside, the evening lamps have just been lit. I know I'm in the infirmary, because it's the only place in all of Blackcliff with white walls. The room is empty of everything but the bed in which I lie, a small table, and a plain wooden chair occupied by a dozing Helene. She looks terrible, her face covered in bruises and scratches.
Elias!
Her eyes fly open when she hears me move.
Thank the skies! You've been out for 2 days.
Remind me,
I croak, my throat dry, head aching. Something happened on the cliffs. Something strange. Helene pours me a glass of water from a pitcher on the table.
We were attacked by Ifrits during the second trial, on our way down the cliffs.
One of them cut the rope,
I say, remembering. But then...
You stuffed me in that niche, but didn't have the sense to hold on to it yourself.
Helene glowers at me, but her hands shake as she gives me the water.
Then you dropped like a lead weight, smacked your head on the way down. You should have died, but that rope between us anchored you. I sang at the top of my lungs until every last ifrit bolted. Then I got you to the desert floor and holed up in a little cave behind some tumbleweeds. Good little fort, actually. Easy to defend.
You had to fight. Again.
The augurs tried to kill us 4 more times. The scorpions were obvious, but the viper almost got you. Then there were whites. Evil little bastards, them. Nothing like the stories. Pain in the ass to kill, too. You have to squash them like bugs. The legionnaires were the worst, though.
Helene goes pale, and the dark humor in her voice fades.
They kept coming. I'd take down 1 or 2, and 4 more would replace them. They'd have rushed me, but the opening to the cave was too narrow.
How many did you kill?
Too many. But it was them or us, so it's hard to feel guilty.
Them or us. I think of the 4 soldiers I killed in the watchtower stairwell. I guess I should be thankful I didn't have to add to that tally.
At dawn,
she continues,
an augur showed up, ordered the legionnaires to haul you to the infirmary. She said Marcus and Zack were injured too, and that since I was the only one unmarked, I'd won the trial. Then she gave me this.
She pulls back the neck of her tunic to reveal a shimmering, tight-fitting shirt.
Why didn't you tell me you'd won?
Relief floods me. I'd have broken something if Marcus or Zack had taken the victory.
And they gave you a shirt?
Made of living metal,
Helene says.
Augur forged, like our masks. Turns away all blades, the augur said. Even Ceric steel. Good thing, too. Skies only know what we'll face next.
I shake my head. Wraiths and ifrits and wights. Tribal tales come to life. I never dreamt it possible.
The augurs don't let up, do they?
What do you expect, Elias?
Helene asks quietly.
They're choosing the next emperor. That's no small thing. You, we, need to trust them.
She takes a breath, and her next words come out in a rush.
When I saw you fall, I thought you were dead, and there were so many things I needed to say to you.
She brings her hand hesitantly to my face, her shy eyes speaking an unfamiliar language. Not so unfamiliar, Elias. Lavinia Tenalia looked at you like that, and Ceres Corrin. Right before you kissed them. But this is different. This is Helene.
So what? You want to see what it's like. You know you do.
As soon as I think it, I'm disgusted at myself. Helene's not a quick tumble or a knight's indiscretion. She's my best friend. She deserves better.
Elias.
Her voice is slow as a summer breeze, and she bites her lip.
No, don't let her.
I pull my face away, and she snatches her hand back as if from a flame, her cheeks crimson.
Helene.
Don't worry about it.
She shrugs, her tone falsely light.
I guess I'm just happy to see you. Anyway, you never said. How do you feel?
The speed with which she moves on startles me, but I'm so relieved to avoid an awkward conversation that I, too, pretend nothing has happened.
My head hurts. I feel fuzzy. There was this singing. Do you know?
You were probably dreaming.
Helene looks away uncomfortably, and groggy though I might be, I can tell she's hiding something. When the door opens to admit the physician, she jumps from her chair, seemingly relieved at the presence of someone else in the room.
Ah, Vittorius,
the physician says.
Awake at last.
I've never liked him. He's a skeletal, pompous ass who delights in discussing his healing methods while patients writhe in pain. He bustles over and removes the bandage on my leg. My mouth drops open. I expected a bloody wound. But there's nothing left of the injury except a scar that looks weeks old. It tingles when I touch it, but is otherwise free of pain.
A southern poultice, the physician says. Of my own making. I've used it many times, I confess. But with you, I've gotten the formula perfect.
The physician removes the bandage from my head. It's not even bloodstained. A dull ache flares out from behind my ear, and I reach up to feel the ridge of a scar there. If what Helene said was true, this wound should have left me knocked out for weeks. And yet it has healed in days. Miraculous. I contemplate the physician. Too miraculous for this smug bag of bones to have done it on his own. Helene, I note, is pointedly not looking at me.
Did an auger visit?
I ask the physician.
Auger? No. Just myself and the apprentices. And Aquila, of course.
He gives Hel an irritated glance.
Sat in here singing lullabies every chance she got.
The physician pulls a bottle from his pocket.
Bloodroot serum for the pain, he says.
Bloodroot serum. The words trigger something in my mind, but it flits away.
Your fatigues are in the closet, the physician says. You're free to go, though I recommend you take it easy. I've told the Commandant she won't be fit for training or watch until tomorrow.
The second the physician leaves, I turn on Helene.
No poultice in the world could heal wounds like this, and yet I didn't get a visit from an auger. Only you.
The wounds must not have been as bad as you thought.
Helene, tell me about your singing.
She opens her mouth, as if to speak, then breaks for the door faster than a whip. Unfortunately for her, I'm expecting it. Her eyes flash when I grab her hand, and I see her weigh her options. Do I fight him? Is it worth it? I wait her out, and she relents, pulling her fingers from mine and sitting back down.
It started in the cave, she says. You kept twitching like you were having a fit of some kind. When I sang to keep the Ifrits away, you calmed down. Your color was better. Your head wound stopped bleeding. So I kept singing. I got tired as I did it. Weak, like I had a fever.
Her eyes are panicked.
I don't know what it means. I'd never try to harness the spirits of the dead. I'm no witch, Elias, I swear.
I know that, Hel.
Skies, what would my mother make of this? The Black Guard? Nothing good. Marshals believe that supernatural power comes from spirits of the dead, and that only the augurs are possessed by such spirits. Anyone else with even a touch of power would be accused of witchcraft and sentenced to death. The evening's shadows dance across Hel's face, and it reminds me of how she looked when Rowan Goldgale grabbed her and lit her with that strange glow.
Mamie Wheeler used to tell stories,
I say carefully, not wanting to spook Helene.
She talked of humans with strange skills that were awoken by contact with the supernatural. Some could harness strength, others could change the weather. A few could even heal with their voices.
Not possible. Only the augurs have true power.
Helene, we fought wraiths and ifrits 2 nights ago. Who's to say what's possible and what isn't?
Maybe when that ifrit touched you, it woke something up inside you. Something strange.
Helene hands me my fatigues. I've only unsettled her more.
Something inhuman.
Something that probably saved my life.
Hel grabs my shoulder, her slim fingers digging into me.
Promise you won't tell anyone, Elias. Let everyone think the physician is a miracle worker. Please. I have to understand this first. If the Commandant knows, she'll tell the Black Guard, and
they'll try to purge it out of you.
Our secret, I say. She looks marginally relieved. When we leave the infirmary, I'm greeted by a cheer. Varys, Dex, Tristus, Demetrius, Leander, hooting and banging me on the back.
I knew the bastards wouldn't off you. Calls for celebration. Let's smuggle in a keg.
Back up, Helene says. Let him breathe.
She's interrupted by the thudding of the drums.
All new graduates to training field one for combat practice immediately.
The message repeats, and groans and eye-rolling abound.
Do us a favor, Elias, Varys says. When you win and become Grand Overlord, get us out of here, will you?
Oi, Helene says. What about me? What if I win?
If you win, then the docks get shut down and we'll never have any fun again,
Leander says, winking at me.
You twit, Leander. I would not shut down the docks,
Helene fumes.
Just because I don't like brothels.
Leander backs away, his hand protecting his nose.
Forgive him, O hallowed aspirant, Tristus intones, blue eye sparkling. Do not strike him down. He is but a poor servant.
Oh, piss off, all of you, Helene says.
10:30, Elias,
Leander calls as he and the others walk away.
My room. We'll have a proper celebration. Aquila, you could come too, but only if you promise not to break my nose again.
I tell him I won't miss it, and after he and the others leave, Hel hands me a vial.
You almost forgot the bloodroot serum.
Liar!
I realize the source of the niggling feeling I had earlier. I'd promised the slave girl bloodroot 3 days ago. She'll be in terrible pain from her wound. Has she been taking care of it? Has Cook been cleaning it?
Who's liar?
Helene interrupts my thoughts, her voice dangerously serene.
She's no one.
My promise to a scholar slave isn't something Helene will understand. What else happened while I was at the infirmary? Anything interesting? Helene throws me a look that says she's allowing me to change the subject.
Resistance ambushed a mask. Damon Cassius, in his house. Pretty gruesome, apparently. His wife found him this morning. No one heard a thing. The bastards are getting bolder. And there's something else.
She drops her voice.
My father's heard a rumor that the Bloodshrike's dead.
I stare at her incredulously.
The Resistance?
Helene shakes her head.
You know that the Emperor's a few weeks away from Serra, at the most. He started to plan his attack on Blackcliff, on us, the aspirants.
Grandfather warned me about this. Still, it's unpleasant to hear.
When the Bloodshrike heard about the attack plans, he tried to resign his post. So Tyus had him executed.
You can't resign as Bloodshrike.
You serve until you die. Everyone knows that.
Actually, Helene says, the Bloodshrike can resign, but only if the Emperor agrees to release him from service. It's not commonly known. Father says it's some odd loophole in Empire law. Anyway, if the rumor is true, then the Bloodshrike was a fool to even ask. Tyus isn't going to free his right-hand man right when Jen's Tyre is being shoved out of power.
She looks up at me, expecting a response. But I just stare at her, open-mouthed, because something huge has occurred to me. Something I haven't understood until now.
If you do your duty, the Augur said, you have a chance to break the bonds between you and the Empire forever.
I know how to do it. I know how I'll find my freedom. If I win the trials, I become emperor. Nothing but death can release the emperor from his duty to the empire. But that's not the case for the Bloodshrike.
The Bloodshrike can resign, but only if the emperor agrees to release him from service.
I'm not supposed to win the trials.
Helene is.
Because if she wins and I become Bloodshrike, then she can set me free. The revelation is like a punch to the gut and flying all at once. The augur said whoever won two trials first would become emperor. Marcus and Helene are both up one, which means I have to win the next trial, and Helene has to win the fourth. And sometime between now and then, Marcus and Zack have to die.
Elias?
Yes, I say too loudly.
Sorry.
Hel looks annoyed.
Thinking of Lyra?
The mention of the scholar girl is so incongruous to my thoughts that for a second I'm stunned silent and Helene stiffens.
Well, don't mind me then, she says. Not like I just spent 2 days by your bedside, singing you back to life or anything.
For a second, I don't know what to say. I don't know this Helene. She's acting like an actual girl. No, Hel, it's not like that. I'm just tired.
Forget it, she says. I have to get to watch. Aspirant Veturius!
A yearling jogs toward me, a note in his hand. I take the note from him, all the while asking Helene to wait. But she ignores me, and, even as I'm trying to explain, she walks away.
Chapter 25 Lyra. Hours after telling Keenan I'd get out of Blackcliff to meet him, I feel like the world's biggest fool. Tenth Bell has come and gone. The Commandant dismissed me and retreated to her room an hour ago. She shouldn't emerge until dawn, especially since I spiked her tea with Keb Leaf, a scentless, tasteless herb Pop used to help patients rest. Cook and Izzy are asleep in their quarters. The house is silent as a mausoleum. And still I sit in my room, trying to concoct a way out of this place. I can't just walk past the gate guard so late at night. Bad things happen to slaves foolish enough to do so. Besides which, the risk that the Commandant will hear about my midnight wandering is too great. But I can, I decide, create a distraction and sneak past the guards. I think back to the flames that consumed my house on the night of the raid. Nothing distracts better than fire. So, armed with tinder, flint, and a striker, I slip out of my room. A loose black scarf obscures my face, and my dress, high-necked and long-sleeved, conceals both my slave's cuffs and the Commandant's mark, still scabbed and painful. The servants' corridor is empty. I move silently to the wooden gate leading to Blackcliff's grounds and ease it open. It squeals louder than a gutted pig. I grimace and scurry back to my quarters, waiting for someone to come investigate the noise. When no one does, I creep out of my room.
Lyra, where are you going?
I jump and drop the flint and striker to the ground, barely keeping hold of the tinder.
Bleeding skies, Izzy!
Sorry. She picks up the flint and striker, brown eyes widening when she realizes what they are.
You're trying to sneak out.
I'm not, I say. But she gives me a look that makes me fidget. Fine, I am, but I
could help you, she whispers.
I know a way out of the school that even the Legionnaires don't patrol.
It's too dangerous, Izzy.
Right. Of course. She retreats, but then stops, small hands twisting together. If you were planning to set a fire and sneak through the front gate while the guards are distracted, it won't work. The Legionnaires will send the oxes to deal with the fire. They never leave a gate unattended. Never. As soon as she says it, I know she's right. I should have realized that fact myself.
Can you tell me about this
Way out? I ask her. It's a hidden trail, she says. A rock path, and a scanty one at that. I'm sorry, but I'd have to show you, which means I'd have to come with you. I don't mind. It's what a friend would do. She says the word friend like it's a secret she wishes she knew. I'm not saying that we're friends, she continues in a rush. I mean, I don't know. I've never really had a friend. She's about to say it, but she looks away, embarrassed. I'm to meet with my handler, Izzy. If you come and the Commandant catches you, she'll punish me. Maybe kill me, I know. But she might do that anyway if I forget to dust her room or if I look her in the eye. Living with the Commandant is like living with the Reaper. And anyway, do you really have a choice? I mean, she looks almost apologetic. How else are you planning to get out of here? Good point. I don't want her to get hurt. I lost Zara to the Marshals a year ago. I can't bear the thought of another friend suffering at their hands. But I don't want Darren to die either. Every second I waste is a second he is rotting in prison. And it's not as if I'm forcing her into this. Izzy wants to help. A host of what-ifs parade through my head. I silence them. For Darren. All right, I say to Izzy. This hidden trail. Where does it let out? The docks. Is that where you're going? I shake my head. I have to get into the Scholars' Quarter for the Moon Festival, but I can make my way there from the docks. Izzy nods. This way, Lyra. Please don't let her get hurt. She ducks into her room for a cloak, then takes my hand and pulls me to the back of the house.
Chapter 26 Elias. Though the physician excused me from training and watch, my mother doesn't seem to care. A note to me is an order to report to Training Field 2 for hand-to-hand combat. I pocket the bloodroot serum, and will have to wait, and spend the next 2 hours attempting to keep the combat centurion from beating me to a pulp. By the time I change into fresh fatigues and leave the training field, 10th bells come and gone, and I have a party to go to. The boys, and Helene, will be waiting. I shove my hands in my pockets as I walk. I hope hell loosens up a little, at least enough to forget that she was so irritated with me earlier. If I want her to set me free from the Empire, making sure she doesn't hate me seems like a good first step. My fingers brush up against the bottle of bloodroot in my pocket. You told Lyra you'd take it to her, Elias. A voice chides me. Days ago. But I also said I'd join Hel and the boys in the barracks. Hel's already mad at me. If she finds out I'm visiting scholar slave girls in the dead of night, she won't be pleased. I stop and consider. If I'm quick about it, Hel will never know where I've been. The Commandant's house is dark, but I stick to the shadows anyway. The slaves might be in bed, but if my mother's asleep, then I'm a swamp djinn. I prowl around to the servants' entrance, thinking to leave the oil in the kitchen. Then I hear voices.
This hidden trail, where does it let out?
I recognize the speaker's murmur. Lyra.
The docks.
That's Izzy, the kitchen slave.
Is that where you're going?
After listening a moment longer, I realize that they're planning to take the treacherous hidden trail out of the school and into Serra. The trail isn't watched, solely because no one is stupid enough to risk sneaking out that way. Demetrius and I tried it without ropes on a dare 6 months ago and nearly broke our necks. The girls will have a hell of a time making it across, and it will be doubly miraculous if they make it back. I start after them, thinking to tell them that the risk isn't worth it, not even for the legendary Moon Festival. But then the air shifts and freezes me in my tracks. I smell grass and snow.
So,
Helene says from behind me.
That's who Lyra is. A slave.
She shakes her head.
I thought you were better than the others, Elias. I never imagined you would take a slave to your bed.
It's not like that. I wince at how I sound, like a typical bumbling male, denying wrongdoing to his woman. Except Helene's not my woman. Lyra's not.
Do you think I'm stupid? Or blind?
There is something dangerous in Helene's eyes.
I saw how you looked at her. That day when she brought us to the Commandant's house before the trial of courage. Like she was water and you were just dying of thirst.
Hel collects herself.
Doesn't matter. I'm reporting her and her friend to the Commandant right now.
For what? I'm astounded at Helene, at the depths of her anger.
For sneaking out of Blackcliff.
Helene's practically gnashing her teeth.
For defying their master, attempting to attend an illegal festival.
They're just girls, Hel.
They're slaves, Elias. Their only concern is pleasing their master. And in this case, I assure you, their master would not be pleased.
Calm down. I look around, worried someone will hear us.
Lyra's a person, Helene. Someone's daughter or sister.
If you or I had been born to different parents, we might be in her shoes instead of our own.
What are you saying? That I should feel sorry for the scholars? That I should think of them as equals? We conquered them. We rule them now. It's the way of the world.
Not all conquered people are turned into slaves. In the southern lands, the lake people conquered the fens and brought them into the fold.
What is wrong with you?
Helene stares at me as if I've sprouted another head.
The Empire has rightfully annexed this land. It's our land. We fought for it, died for it, and now we're tasked with keeping it. If doing so means we have to keep the scholars enslaved, so be it. Have a care, Elias. If anyone heard you spouting this trash, the Black Guard would toss you into Koff without a thought.
What happened to you wanting to change things? Her righteousness is getting damn irritating. I thought she was better than this.
That night after graduation, you said you'd improve things for the scholars. I meant better living conditions, not setting them free. Elias, look at what the bastards have been doing. Raiding caravans, killing innocent Illustrians in their beds.
You're not actually referring to Damon Cassius as innocent.
He's a mask. The girl's a slave.
Helene snaps.
And the Commandant deserves to know what her slaves are doing. Not telling her is tantamount to aiding and abetting the enemy. I'm turning them in.
No, I say. You're not. My mother's already made her mark on Lyra. She's already gouged out Izzy's eye. I know what she'll do if she learns they snuck out. There won't be enough left to feed the scavengers. Helene crosses her arms in front of her.
How do you plan to stop me?
That healing power of yours, I say, hating myself for blackmailing her, but knowing it's the only thing that will get her to back down. The Commandant would be mighty interested in that, don't you think? Helene goes still. In the light of the full moon, the shock and hurt on her masked face hit me like a blow to the chest. She backs away, as if worried that I'll spread my sedition, as if it's a plague.
You're unbelievable,
she says.
After everything,
she sputters. She's so angry, but then she draws herself up, pulling out the mask that lives at her core. Her voice goes flat, her face expressionless.
I want nothing to do with you, she says. If you want to be a traitor, you're on your own. You stay away from me. In training, at watch, in the trials, just stay away.
Damn it, Elias. I needed to make up with Helene tonight, not antagonize her further.
Hel, come on.
I reach for her arm, but she wants none of it. She throws off my hand and stalks off into the night. I gaze after her, pole-axed. She doesn't mean it, I tell myself. She just needs to cool down. By tomorrow, she'll be rational. I can explain why I didn't want to turn the girls in. And apologize for blackmailing her with knowledge she trusted me to keep secret. I grimace. Yes, I'll definitely wait until tomorrow. If I approach her now, she'll probably try to geld me. But that still leaves Lyra and Izzy. I stand in the dark, considering.
Mind your own business, Elias, part of me says. Leave the girls to their fate. Go to Leander's party. Get drunk.
Idiot, a second voice says. Follow the girls and talk them out of this lunacy before they get caught and killed. Go. Now. I listen to the second voice. I follow.
Chapter 27 Lyra. Izzy and I sneak across the courtyard, our eyes flicking nervously to the windows of the Commandant's rooms. They're dark, which I hope means that for once she's asleep.
Tell me, Izzy whispers.
You ever climbed a tree?
Of course.
Then this will be a cinch for you. It's not much different, really. 10 minutes later, I teeter on a 6-inch-wide ledge, hundreds of feet above the dunes, glaring daggers at Izzy. She is skittering along ahead, swinging from rock to rock like a trim blonde monkey.
This is not a cinch, I hiss.
This is nothing like climbing trees. Izzy peers down at the dunes, speculatively.
I hadn't realized how high it was.
Above us, a heavy yellow moon dominates the star-strewn sky. It's a beautiful summer night, warm without a breath of wind. Since death lurks a misstep away, I can't bring myself to enjoy it. After taking a deep gulp of air, I move another few inches down the path, praying the stone won't crumble beneath my feet. Izzy looks back at me.
Not there! Not there! Not... Go!
My foot slips, only to land on solid rock a few inches lower than I expect.
Shut it!
Izzy flaps a hand at me.
You'll wake after school!
The cliff is pocked with knobs of jutting rock, some of which deteriorate as soon as I touch them. There is a trail here, but it is more appropriate for squirrels than humans. My foot slips on a particularly crumbly bit of stone, and I hug the cliff face until the vertigo sweeps past. A minute later, I accidentally shove my finger into the home of some angry, sharp-pincered creature, and it scuttles over my hand and arm. I bite my lip to suppress a scream and shake my arm so vigorously that the scabs over my heart open. I hiss at the sudden, searing pain.
Come on, Lyra,
Izzy calls from ahead of me.
Almost there.
I force myself forward, trying to ignore the maw of grasping air at my back. When we finally reach a wide patch of solid ground, I nearly kiss the dirt in thankfulness. The river laps calmly at the nearby docks, the masts of dozens of small riverboats bobbing gently up and down like a forest of dancing spears.
See, Izzy says, that wasn't so bad.
We still have to go back. Izzy doesn't answer. Instead, she looks intently into the shadows behind me. I turn, searching them with her, listening for anything out of the ordinary. The only sound is of water slapping hull.
Sorry, she shakes her head. I thought... Never mind. Lead the way.
The docks crawl with laughing drunks and sailors stinking of sweat and salt. The ladies of the night beckon to anyone passing, their eyes like fading coals. Izzy stops to stare, but I pull her after me. We stick to the shadows, trying our best to disappear into the darkness, to catch no one's eye. Soon we leave the docks behind. The further we get into Serra, the more familiar the streets become, until we climb over a low section of mud brick wall and into the quarter. Home. I never appreciated the smell of the quarter before. Clay and earth, and the warmth of animals living close together. I trace my finger through the air, marveling at the whirls of dust dancing in the soft moonlight. Laughter tinkles from nearby, a door slams, a child shouts, and beneath it all, the low murmur of conversation thrums. So different from the silence that weighs on Blackcliff like a death shroud. Home. I want it to be true, but this isn't home. Not anymore. My home was taken from me. My home was burned to the ground. We make our way toward the square at the center of the quarter, where the moon festival is in full swing. I push back my scarf and undo my bun, letting my hair fall loose like all the other young women. Beside me, Izzy's right eye is wide as she takes it all in. "I've never seen anything like this," she says. "It's beautiful. It's..." I take the pins from her fair hair. She puts her hands to her head, blushing, but I pull them down. "Just for tonight," I say, "or we won't blend in. Come on." Smiles greet us as we make our way through the exuberant crowds. Drinks are offered, salutations exchanged, compliments murmured, sometimes shouted, to Izzy's embarrassment. It is impossible not to think of Darin and how much he loved the festival. 2 years ago, he dressed in his finest clothing and dragged us to the square early. That was when he and Nan still laughed together, when Pop's advice was law, when he had no secrets from me. He brought me stacks of mooncakes, round and yellow like the full moon. He admired the sky lanterns that lit the streets, strung so cleverly that they looked as if they were floating. When the fiddles warbled and the drums thumped, he grabbed Nan and paraded her around the dance stages until she was breathless with laughter. This year's festival is packed, but remembering Darin, I feel wrenchingly alone. I've never thought about all the empty spaces at the Moon Festival, all the places where the disappeared, the dead, and the lost should be. What's happening to my brother in prison while I stand in this joyful crowd? How can I smile or laugh when I know he's suffering? I glance at Izzy, at the wonder and joy on her face, and sigh, pushing away the dark thoughts for her sake. There must be other people here who feel as lonely as I do. Yet no one frowns, or cries, or sulks. They all find reason to smile and laugh. Reason to hope. I spot one of Pop's former patients and make a sharp turn away from her, pulling my scarf back up to shadow my face. The crowd is thick, and it will be easy to lose anyone familiar in the throng. But it's better if I go unrecognized. "Lia?" Izzy's voice is small, her touch light on my arm. "Now what do we do?" "Whatever we want," I say. "Someone is supposed to find me. Until he does, we watch, dance, eat. We blend in." I eye a nearby cart, manned by a laughing couple and surrounded by a mob of outstretched hands. "Izzy, have you ever tasted a mooncake?" I cut through the crowd, emerging minutes later with two hot mooncakes dripping with chilled cream. Izzy takes a slow bite, closes her eye, and smiles. We wander to the dance stages, filled with pairs, husbands and wives, fathers and daughters, siblings, friends. I shed the slave's shuffle I've adopted and walk the way I used to, my head straight and my shoulders thrown back. Beneath my dress, my wound stings, but I ignore it. Izzy finishes off her mooncake and stares at mine so intently that I hand it over. We find a bench and watch the dancers for a few minutes until Izzy nudges me. "You have an admirer." She gobbles up the last bite of cake. "By the musicians?" I look over, thinking it must be Keenan, but instead see a young man with a somewhat bemused expression on his face. He seems distantly familiar. "Do you know him?" Izzy asks. "No," I say after considering for a few moments. "I don't think so." The young man is tall as a marshal, with broad shoulders and sun-gold arms that gleam in the lantern light. The hard lines of his stomach are visible beneath his hooded vest, even from this distance. The black strap of a pack cuts diagonally across his chest. Though his hood is up, shadowing much of his face, I see high cheekbones, a straight nose, and full lips. His features are arresting, almost illustrian, but his clothes and the dark shine of his eyes mark him as a tribesman. Izzy watches the boy, studying him almost. "Are you sure you don't know him? Because he definitely seems to know you." "No, I've never seen him before." The boy and I lock eyes, and when he smiles, blood rushes to my cheeks. I look away, but the draw of his stare is powerful, and a moment later, my gaze creeps back. He's still looking at me, arms folded across his chest. A second later, I feel a hand on my shoulder and smell cedar and wind. "Lawyer." The beautiful boy by the stage is forgotten as I turn to Keenan. I take in his dark eyes and red hair, not realizing that he's staring back until a few seconds have passed and he clears his throat. Izzy slips a few feet away, eyeing Keenan with interest. I told her that when the resistance showed up, she was to act like she didn't know me. Somehow, I don't think they will appreciate that a fellow slave knows all about my mission. "Come on," Keenan says, weaving past the dance stages and between two tents. I follow, and Izzy trails us discreetly and at a distance. "You found your way," he adds. "It was simple enough." "I doubt that, but you managed it. Well done. You look..." His eyes search my face and then travel down my body. Such a look from another man would merit a slap, but from Keenan, it's more tribute than insult. There is something different about his usually aloof features. Surprise? Admiration? When I smile tentatively at him, he gives his head a slight shake as if clearing it. "Is Sana here?" I ask.
"She's at base."
His shoulders are tense, and I can tell he's troubled.
"She wanted to see you herself, but Mazin didn't want her to come. They had quite a battle over it. Her faction's been pushing for Mazin to get Darren out. But Mazin..."
He clears his throat and, as if he's said too much, nods tersely to a tent ahead of us.
"Let's head around back."
A white-haired tribal woman sits in front of the tent, peering into a crystal ball as two scholar girls wait to hear what she'll say. Their faces, skeptical. On one side of her, a torch juggler has amassed a large crowd, and on the other, a tribal Kihani spins her tails, her voice rising and swooping like a bird in flight.
"Hurry up." Keenan's sudden brusqueness startles me. "He's waiting."
When I enter the tent, Mazin stops speaking to the two men flanking him. I recognize them from the cave. They are his other lieutenants, closer to Keenan's age than Mazin's, and possessed of the younger man's taciturn coolness. I stand taller. I won't be intimidated.
"Still in one piece?" Mazin says. "Impressive. What have you got for us?"
I tell him everything I know about the trials and the Emperor's arrival. I don't reveal how I got the information, and Mazin doesn't ask. When I'm done, even Keenan looks stunned. "The marshals will name the new Emperor in less than 2 weeks," I say. "That's why I told Keenan we had to meet tonight. It wasn't easy to get out of Blackcliff, you know. I only risked it because I knew I had to get you this information. It's not everything you wanted, but surely it's enough to convince you that I'll complete the mission. You can get Darren out now." Mazin's brows furrow, and I rush on. "And I'll stay at Blackcliff as long as you need me to.
One of the lieutenants, a stocky, fair-haired man, who I think is called Erin, whispers something in Mazin's ear. Irritation flashes briefly across the older man's eyes.
The death cells aren't like the main prison block, girl, he says. They're near impenetrable. I expected to have a few weeks to break your brother out, which is why I even agreed to do it. These things take time. Supplies and uniforms need procuring, guards need bribing. Less than 2 weeks? That's nothing.
It's possible, Keenan speaks up from behind me. Tarik and I were discussing it.
If I want your opinion, or Tarik's, Mazin says, I'll ask for it.
Keenan's lips go thin, and I expect him to retort. But he just nods, and Mazin goes on.
It's not enough time, he muses. We need to take the whole damn prison. That's not something you can do unless...
He strokes his chin, deep in thought, before nodding.
I have a new mission for you. Find me a way into Blackcliff, a way no one else knows of. Do that, and I'll be able to get your brother out.
I have a way, relief floods me. A hidden trail. It's how I came here.
No,
Mazin punctures my elation as quickly as it had ballooned.
We need something different.
More maneuverable, Erin says.
By a large group of men.
The catacombs run under Blackcliff, Keenan says to Mazin. Some of those tunnels must lead to the school.
Perhaps,
Mazin clears his throat.
We've searched down there before, and found nothing of use. But you, liar, will have an advantage, since you'll be looking from within Blackcliff itself.
He rests his fists on the table and leans toward me.
We need something soon, a week at most. I'll send Keenan to give you a specific date. Don't miss that meeting.
I'll find you an entrance, I say. Izzy will know of something. One of the tunnels beneath Blackcliff must be unguarded. This, finally, is a task I know I can accomplish. But how will an entrance into Blackcliff help you break Darin out of the death cells?
A fair question, Keenan says softly.
He meets Mazin's gaze, and I'm surprised at the open hostility in the older man's face.
I have a plan. That's all that any of you need to know.
Mazin nods at Keenan, who touches my arm and makes for the door of the tent, indicating I should follow. For the first time since the raid, I feel light, as if just maybe I'll be able to accomplish what I set out to do. Outside the tent, the fire thrower is mid-show, and I spot Izzy in the crowd, clapping as the flame lights a night. I am almost giddy with hope until I see Keenan watching the dancers whirl, his brow furrowed. What's wrong?
Will you,
He runs a hand through his hair, and I don't think I've ever seen him so agitated.
Will you honor me with a dance?
I'm not sure what I am expecting him to say, but it isn't that. I manage a nod, and then he's leading me to one of the dance stages. Across the stage, the tall tribal boy from earlier is dancing with a dainty tribeswoman, who has a smile like lightning. The fiddlers begin a swift, tempestuous tune, and Keenan takes my hip in one hand and my fingers in the other. At his touch, my skin comes alive as if warmed by the sun. He's a little stiff, but he knows the steps well enough. You're not bad at this, I say to him. Nan taught me all the old dances. I wonder who taught Keenan.
That shocks you.
I shrug. You don't strike me as a dancing type.
I'm not, usually.
His dark gaze roams over me, as if he's trying to puzzle something out.
I thought you'd be dead within a week, you know. You surprise me.
He finds my eyes.
I'm not used to being surprised.
The warmth of his body envelops me like a cocoon. I feel suddenly deliciously breathless. But then he breaks eye contact, his fine features cold. The prickle of rejection tingles unpleasantly across my skin, even as we continue to dance. He
He's your handler, Lyre. That's all. If it makes you feel any better, I thought I'd be dead within a week too. I smile, and he gives me a quirk of his mouth in return. He holds happiness at bay, I realize. He doesn't trust it. Do you still think I'm going to fail? I ask. I shouldn't have said that. He glances down at me, and then quickly away. But I didn't want to risk the men. Or you. He mutters these words, and I lift my eyebrows in disbelief. Me? I say. You threatened to shove me into a crypt 5 seconds after meeting me. Keenan's neck reddens, and he's still refusing to look at me. I'm sorry about that. I was a jackass? I offer helpfully. He smiles in full this time, dazzling and all too brief. When he nods, it's almost shy, but moments later, he's serious again. When I said you would fail, I was trying to scare you. I didn't want you to go to Blackcliff. Why? Because I knew your father. No, that's not right. He shakes his head. Because I owe your father. I stop mid-dance, only picking up again when someone jostles us. Keenan takes that as his cue to continue. He picked me up off the streets when I was 6. It was winter, and I was begging. Not very successfully, either. I was probably a few hours from dead. Your father brought me to camp, clothed me, fed me. He gave me a bed. A family. I'll never forget his face. Or how he sounded when he asked me to come with him. Like I was doing him a favor, instead of the other way around. I smile. That was my father, all right. The first time I saw your face in the light, you looked familiar. I couldn't place you, but I knew you. When you told us, he shrugs. I don't agree with the old-timers about much, he says. But I do agree that it's wrong to leave your brother in prison when we can help him, especially since it's our men who put him there. And especially since your parents did more for most of us than we can ever repay them for. But sending you to Blackcliff, he scowls. That's poor repayment to your father. I know why Mazin did it. He needed to make both factions happy, and giving you a mission was the best way. But I still don't think it's right. Now I'm the one flushing, because this is the most he's ever spoken to me. And there's a vehemence in his face that's almost too much. I'm doing my best to survive, I say lightly. Lest you waste away with guilt. You will survive, Keenan says. All of the rebels have lost someone. It's why they fight. But you and me, we're the ones who've lost everyone. Everything. We're alike, Lyre. So, you can trust me when I say that you're strong, whether you know it or not. You'll find that entrance. I know you will. They are the warmest words I've heard in so long. Our eyes lock again, but this time Keenan doesn't look away. The rest of the world fades as we whirl. I say nothing, for the quiet between us is sweet and graceful, and of our own choosing. And though he, too, doesn't speak, his dark eyes smolder, telling me something I don't quite understand. Desire, low and dizzying, unfurls in my stomach. I want to hold this closeness to me as if it's a treasure. I don't want to release it. But then the music stops, and Keenan lets go of me. Get back safe. His words are perfunctory, as if he's speaking to one of his fighters. I feel as if I've been doused with river water. Without another word, he disappears into the crowd. The fiddlers begin a different tune. The dance picks up around me, and like a fool, I stare into the crush, knowing he won't come back, but hoping anyway.
Chapter 28 Elias. Sneaking into the Moon Festival is child's play. I pocket my mask, my face serves as my best disguise, and burgle riding clothes and a pack from a tribal caravan. After that, I break into an apothecary for Willadonna, a physician's staple that, when pressed into an oil, dilates the pupils wide enough for a marshal to pass as a scholar or tribesman for an hour or two. Easy. Moments after putting the Willadonna in, I'm swept into the heart of the festival with a tide of scholars. I count 12 exits and identify 20 potential weapons before I realize what I'm doing and force myself to relax. I pass food stalls and dance stages, jugglers and fire eaters, acrobats, kihanis, singers and players. Musicians strum ouds and lyres, guided by the jubilant beat of drums. I pull out of the crowds, suddenly disoriented. It's been so long since I've heard drums as music that I instinctively try to translate the beats into orders and find myself bewildered when I cannot. When I finally am able to push the thudding to the back of my head, I'm bowled over by the colors and smells and unadulterated joy around me. Even as a fiver, I never saw anything like this. Not in Marin or the tribal deserts, not even beyond the Empire, where woad-coated barbarians danced beneath starlight for days, as if possessed. A pleasant peacefulness steals over me. No one looks at me with loathing or fear. I don't have to watch my back or keep up the granite exterior. I feel free. For a few minutes, I meander through the crowd, eventually making my way to the dance stages, where I've spotted Lyra and Izzy. The two were surprisingly difficult to follow. While tracking them through the docks, I lost sight of Lyra a few times altogether. But once in the quarter, under the bright lights of the sky lanterns, I find the girls easily. At first, I think to approach them, tell them who I am, and get them back to Blackcliff. But they look like I feel, free, happy. I can't bring myself to ruin it for them, not when their lives are ordinarily so dismal. So instead, I watch. They both wear plain black silk dresses, which, while excellent for sneaking around and keeping slaves' cuffs hidden, don't blend so well into the rainbow plumage of the throng. Izzy has let her blonde hair fall into her face, masking her eye patch surprisingly well. She makes herself small, barely noticeable as she peeks out from the curtain of her hair. Lyra, on the other hand, would be noticeable pretty much anywhere. The high-necked dress she's wearing clings to her body in ways I find painfully unfair. Beneath the light of the sky lanterns, her skin glows the color of warm honey. She holds her head high, the elegance of her neck heightened by the inky fall of her hair. I want to touch that hair, smell it, run my hands through it, wrap it around my wrist, and... Damn it, Vittorius! Get a hold of yourself. Stop staring. After I pull my eyes from her, I realize that I'm not the only one dumbstruck. Many of the young men around me sneak glances at her. She doesn't seem to notice, which, of course, makes her all the more intriguing. And here you are, Elias, staring at her again, you twit. This time, my attention hasn't gone unobserved. Izzy is watching me. The girl might have only one eye, but I'm fairly certain she sees more than most. Get out of here, Elias, I tell myself, before she figures out why you look so damn familiar. Izzy leans over and whispers something into Lyra's ear. I'm about to walk away when Lyra looks up at me. Her eyes are a dark jolt. I should look away. I should leave. She'll figure out who I am if she stares long enough. But I can't bring myself to move. For a heavy, heated moment, we are immobile, content to watch each other.
Skies, she's beautiful. I smile at her, and the blush that rises on her face makes me feel oddly triumphant. I want to ask her to dance. I want to touch her skin and talk to her, and pretend that I'm just a normal tribal boy, and she's just a normal scholar girl. Stupid idea, my mind warns. She'll recognize you. So what? What would she do? Turn me in? She can't tell the commandant she saw me here without incriminating herself too. But while I'm still considering, a muscular, red-haired boy comes up behind her. He touches her shoulder with a possessiveness in his eyes that I don't like. Lyra, in return, stares at him as if no one else exists. Maybe she knew him before she became a slave. Maybe he's the reason she snuck out. I scowl and look away. He's not bad-looking, I suppose, but he seems too grim to be any fun. Also, he's shorter than me, considerably shorter, half a foot at least. Lyra leaves with the redhead. Izzy gets up after a moment and follows.
Looks like she's taken, lad.
A tribal girl wearing a bright green dress, covered in tiny circular mirrors, sashays up to me, her dark hair done up in hundreds of braids. She speaks Sudhese, the tribal tongue I grew up with. Against her dusky skin, her smile is a blinding flash of white, and I find myself returning it.
I guess I'll have to do, she says.
Without waiting for a reply, she pulls me to the dance floor, a remarkably bold thing for a tribal girl to do. I look at her closely and realize that she's not a girl, but a grown woman, perhaps a few years older than me. I eye her warily. Most tribeswomen have a few children by their mid-twenties. Don't you have a husband who'll take off my head if he sees me dancing with you? I respond in Sudhese.
I don't. Why? Are you interested in the position?
She runs a warm, slow finger down the skin of my chest and stomach, all the way to my belt. For the first time in a decade or so, I blush. Her wrist, I notice, is free of the tribal braid tattoo that would mark her as married.
What's your name and tribe, lad?
She asks. She's a good dancer, and when I match her step for step, I can tell she's pleased.
Ilias.
I haven't spoken my tribal name in years. Grandfather martialized it within about 5 minutes of meeting me.
Ilias Ansaif.
As soon as I say it, I wonder if it's a mistake. The story of Mamie Rila's adopted son being taken to Blackcliff isn't well known. The Empire ordered Tribe Saif to keep it quiet. Still, tribesmen love to talk. But if the woman recognizes the name, she doesn't acknowledge it.
I'm Afia Ara Nur,
she says. Shadows and light. I translate her first name and her tribal name. Fascinating combination.
Mostly shadows, to be honest.
She leans toward me, and the smolder in her brown eyes makes my heart beat a little faster.
But keep that between us.
I tilt my head as I look at her. I don't think I've ever met a tribal woman with such sultry self-possession. Not even a Kahani. Afia smiles a secret smile and asks me a few polite questions about Tribe Saif. How many weddings have we had in the past month? How many births? Will we journey to Nur for the fall gathering? Though the questions are suitable for a tribal woman, I'm not fooled. Her simple words don't match the sharp intelligence of her eyes. Where is her family? Who is she really? As if sensing my suspicion, Afia tells me of her brothers, rug traders based in Nur, here to sell their wares before bad weather closes off the mountain passes. As she speaks, I look around surreptitiously for these brothers of hers. Tribal men are notoriously protective of their unwed women, and I'm not looking for a fight. But though there are plenty of tribesmen in the crowd, none of them so much as look at Afia.
We stay together for 3 dances. When the last is over, Afia curtsies and offers me a wooden coin with the sun on one side and clouds on the other.
A gift, she says, for honoring me with such fine dances, Ilias and Saif.
The honor is mine. I'm surprised. Tribal tokens mark a favor owed. They're not offered lightly and are rarely given out by women. As if she knows what I'm thinking, Afia stands on her tiptoes. She's so tiny, I have to stoop to hear her.
If the heir of Gens Veturia should ever need a favor, Ilias, Tribe Noor will be honored to be of service.
Immediately, my body tenses, but she puts 2 fingers to her lips, the most binding of tribal vows.
Your secret is safe with Afiar Aranur.
I raise an eyebrow. Whether she recognized the name Ilias or has seen me around Sarah masked, I don't know. Whoever Afia Aranur is, she's no simple tribal woman. I nod in acknowledgement, and her white teeth flash.
Ilias.
She drops down, no longer whispering.
Your lady is free now. See?
I look over my shoulder. Lyra has returned to the dance stage and is watching the redhead walk away from her.
You must claim her for a dance,
Afia says.
Go on.
She gives me a small shove and disappears, the bells on her ankle tinkling. I stare after her for a moment, looking at the coin thoughtfully before pocketing it. Then I turn and make my way to Lyra.
Chapter 29. Lyra. May I? My mind is still on Keenan, and I am startled to find the tribal boy standing beside me. For a moment, I can only stare dumbly up at him. Would you like to dance? He clarifies, offering a hand. The low hood shadows his eyes, but his lips curve into a smile. Now that I've given my report, Izzy and I should get back to Blackcliff. Dawn is still a few hours away, but I shouldn't risk getting caught. Ah, the boy smiles. The redhead. Your husband? What? No. Fiancé? No, he's not. Lover? The boy lifts an eyebrow suggestively. My face grows hot. He's my friend. Then why worry? The boy flashes a grin, tinged with wickedness, and I find myself smiling in return. I glance over my shoulder at Izzy, talking to an earnest-looking scholar. She laughs at something he says, her hands, for once, not straying to her eye patch. When she catches me watching, she looks between the tribal boy and me and waggles her eyebrows. My face goes hot again. One dance can't hurt. We can leave after. The fiddlers are playing a lilting ballad, and at my nod, the boy takes my hands as confidently as if we'd been friends for years. Despite his height and the width of his shoulders, he leads with a grace that is effortless and sensual all at once. When I peek at him, I find him staring down at me, a faint smile on his lips. My breath hitches, and I cast about for something to say. You don't sound like a tribesman. There, that's neutral enough. You've hardly got an accent. Though his eyes are scholar dark, his face is all edges and hard lines. You don't really look like one either. I can say something in Sedhese, if you like. He drops his lips to my ear, and the spice of his breath sends a pleasant shiver through me. Menaya Espula Dilla de Canala. I sigh. No wonder tribesmen can sell anything. His voice is warm and deep like summer honey dripping off the comb. What? My voice is hoarse, and I clear my throat. What does it mean? He gives me that smile again. I'd really have to show you. Up comes the blush. You're very bold.
I narrow my eyes. Where have I seen him before? Do you live around here? You seem familiar. And you're calling me bold. I look away, realizing how my comment must sound. He chuckles in response, low and hot, and my breath catches again. I feel suddenly sorry for the girls in his tribe. I'm not from Sarah, he says. So, who's the redhead? Who's the brunette? I challenge back. Ah, you were spying on me. That's very flattering. I wasn't. I was... So were you. It's all right, he says reassuringly. I don't mind if you spy on me. The brunette is Afia of Tribe Nur. A new friend. Just a friend. Looked to me like a bit more than that. Maybe, he shrugs. You never answered my question. About Red? Red is a friend. I mimic the boy's pensive tone. A new friend. The boy tosses his head back and laughs, a laugh that falls gentle and wild, like desert rain. You live in the quarter? He asks. I hesitate. I can't tell him I'm a slave. Slaves aren't allowed at the Moon Festival. Even a stranger to Sarah will know that. Yes, I say. I've lived in the quarter for years, with my grandparents, and my brother. Our house isn't far from here. I don't know why I say it. Perhaps I think that by speaking the words, they will prove true, and I will turn to see Darin flirting with girls, Nan hawking her jams, and Pop dealing, ever gently, with overly worried patience. The boy spins me around and then pulls me back into the circle of his arms, closer than before. His smell, spicy and heady and bizarrely familiar, makes me want to lean closer, to inhale. The hard planes of his muscles press into me, and when his hips brush mine, I nearly fumble my steps. And how do you fill your days? Pop's a healer. My voice falters at the lie, but since I can't very well tell him the truth, I rush on. My brother's his apprentice. Nan and I make jam, mostly for the tribes. You strike me as a jam maker. Really? Why? He grins down at me. Up close, his eyes look almost black, especially shadowed, as they are by long eyelashes. Right now, they shine with barely restrained mirth. Because you're so sweet, he says in a mock saccharine voice. The mischief in his eyes makes me forget, for a too brief second, that I am a slave, and that my brother is in prison, and that everyone else I love is dead. Laughter explodes out of me like a song, and my eyes blur and tear. A snort escapes, which sets my dance partner to laughing, which makes me laugh harder. Only Darin ever made me laugh like this. The release is foreign and familiar, like crying, but without the pain. What's your name? I ask as I wipe my face. But instead of answering, he goes still, his head cocked, as if he's listening for something. When I speak, he puts a finger to my lips. A moment later, his face hardens. We have to go, he says. If he didn't look so dead serious, I'd think he was trying to get me to come with him to his camp. A raid. A martial raid. Around us, dancers spin on obliviously. None of them has heard the boy. Drums thump, children scamper and giggle. All seems well. Then he shouts it, loud enough that everyone can hear. Raid! Run! His deep voice echoes across the dance stages, as commanding as a soldier's. The fiddlers stop mid-note, the drums cease. Marshal raid! Get out! Go! A burst of light shatters the silence. One of the sky lamps has exploded, and another. Arrows zing through the air. The marshals are shooting out the lights, hoping to leave the festival-goers in darkness so they can herd us easily. Lawyer! Izzy is beside me, eye wide with panic. What's happening? Some years the marshals let us have the festival. Other years, they don't. We have to get out of here. I grab Izzy's hand,
wishing I'd never brought her, wishing I'd thought more of her safety. Follow me. The boy doesn't wait for an answer, just pulls me to a nearby street, one that isn't yet flooded with people. He keeps to the walls, and I follow behind, holding tightly to Izzy and hoping it's not too late for us to escape. When we reach the middle of the street, the tribesman pulls us into a narrow, trash-strewn alley. Screams rend the air and steel flashes. Seconds later, festival-goers stream past, many falling out of sight, cut down as they run, like stalks of wheat beneath a sickle. We have to get out of the quarter before they lock it down, the tribesman says. Anyone caught in the streets will be thrown into ghost wagons. You'll have to move fast. Can you do that?
We can't go with you. I pull my hand from the boys. He'll head for his caravan, but Izzy and I will find no safety there. Once his people see we're slaves, they'll turn us over to the marshals, who will turn us over to the commandant, and then... We don't live in the quarter. I'm sorry, I lied. I back away, pulling Izzy with me, knowing that the quicker we go our separate ways, the better it will be for all concerned. The tribesman shoves back his hood to reveal a head of close-cropped black hair.
I know that, he says. And though his voice is the same, there's something subtly different about him. A menace, a power in his body that wasn't there before. Without thinking, I take another step back.
You have to go to Blackcliff, he says.
For a moment, his words don't register. When they do, my knees go weak. He's a spy. Did he see my slave's cuffs? Did he overhear me talking to Mazin? Will he turn Izzy and me in? Then Izzy gasps. Aspirant Veturius. When Izzy says his name, it's like lamplight flooding a murky chamber. His features, his height, his easy grace. Everything makes perfect sense, and yet no sense at all. What is an aspirant doing at a moon festival? Why was he trying to pass as a tribesman? Where's his damned mask?
Your eyes.
They were dark, I think wildly. I'm sure they were dark.
Willadonna, he says, broadens the pupils. Look, we should really...
You're spying on me for the commandant, I burst out. It's the only explanation. Keris Veturia ordered her son to follow me, to see what I know. But if that's the case, he probably overheard me talking to Mazin and Keenan. He has more than enough information to turn me in for treason. Why dance with me? Why laugh and joke with me? Why warn the festival goers about the raid?
I wouldn't spy for her if it meant my life.
Then why are you here? There's no possible reason.
There is. But it's not one I can explain right now. Veturius looks to the streets, then adds, We can argue about it if you like, or we can get the hell out of here.
He's a mask, and I should look away from him. I should show my subservience, but I can't stop staring. It's a jolt, his face. A few minutes ago, I thought he was beautiful. I thought his words in sad ease were hypnotic. I danced with a mask. A bleeding, burning mask. Veturius peers out of the alleyway and shakes his head.
The legionnaires will have sealed off the quarter by the time we get to one of the gates. We'll have to take the tunnels and hope they haven't sealed those off.
He moves confidently to a grate in the alleyway, as if he knows exactly where we are in the quarter. When I don't follow, he makes a sound of irritation.
Look, I'm not in league with her, he says. In fact, if she finds out I came here, she'll probably flay me. Slowly. But that's nothing compared to what she'll do to you if you're caught in this raid or if she discovers you missing from Blackcliff at dawn. If you want to live, you'll have to trust me. Now move.
Izzy does as he says, and reluctantly I follow, my whole body rebelling at the thought of putting my life in the hands of a mask. Almost as soon as we drop down into the tunnel, Veturius pulls fatigues and boots from the bag across his chest and begins tearing off his tribal clothes. My face burns and I turn away, but not before seeing the chilling map
of silvery scarves across his back. Seconds later, he walks past us, masked once more and gesturing for us to follow. Izzy and I run to keep up with his long strides. He moves, stealthily, as a cat, silent but for a word of encouragement here and there. We make our way north and east through the catacombs, stopping only to avoid passing martial patrols. Veturius never falters. When we reach a pile of skulls blocking the passage ahead, he moves a few aside and helps us through the opening. When the tunnel we're in narrows to a locked grate, he plucks two pins from my hair and picks the lock in seconds. Izzy and I exchange a glance at that. His sheer competence is unnerving. I've no idea how much time has passed. At least 2 hours. It must be nearly dawn. We won't make it back on time. The Commandant will catch us. Skies, I shouldn't have brought Izzy. I shouldn't have put her at risk. My wound chafes against my dress until it's bleeding. It is only a few days old and the infection has lingered. The pain combined with my fear makes me light-headed. Veturius slows when he sees my face. We're almost there, he says. Do you need me to carry you? I shake my head vehemently. I don't want to be close to him again. I don't want to breathe in his smell or feel the warmth of his skin. Eventually, we stop. Low voices mutter from around the corner ahead of us, and a flickering torch deepens the shadows the light can't reach. All the underground entrances to Blackcliff are guarded, Veturius whispers. This one has 4 guards. If they see you, they'll sound an alarm, and these tunnels will be swarming with soldiers. He looks between Izzy and me to make sure we understand before going on. I'm going to draw them off. When I say docks, you'll have a minute to get around this corner, up the ladder and out the grate. When I say Madame Modes, it means you're nearly out of time. Shut the grate behind you. You'll be in Blackcliff's main cellar. Wait for me there. Veturius disappears into the gloom of a tunnel just behind us. A few minutes later, we hear what sounds like drunken singing. I peer around the corner to see the guards elbowing each other and grinning. 2 leave to investigate. Veturius's voice is convincingly slurred, and there's a loud crash followed by a curse and a burst of laughter. One of the soldiers who's gone to investigate calls to the other 2. They disappear. I lean forward, preparing to run. Come on, come on. Finally, Veturius's voice drifts down the tunnels.
Down by the dockish.
Izzy and I bolt for the ladder, and in seconds we've reached the grate. I'm congratulating myself on our speed when Izzy, perched above me, lets out a strangled cry. I can't get it open! I climb past her, grab the grate and shove it upward. It doesn't budge. The guards get closer. I hear another loud crash, and then Veturius saying,
The best girls are mammos. They really know how to...
Liar! Izzy looks frantically toward the fast-approaching torchlight. 10 burning hells. With a muffled grunt, I throw my whole body toward the grate, wincing at the pain lancing through my torso. The grate creaks open unwillingly, and I practically shove Izzy through before leaping up myself, shutting it just as the soldiers emerge into the tunnel below. Izzy takes cover behind a barrel, and I join her. A few seconds later, Veturius climbs out of the grate, giggling drunkenly. Izzy and I exchange another glance, and, as preposterous as it is, I find I'm suppressing my laughter.
Thanks, boys,
Veturius calls down into the tunnel. He slams the grate shut, spots us and holds a finger to his lips. The soldiers can still hear us through the slats in the grate.
Aspirant Veturius, Izzy whispers. What will happen to you if the Commandant finds out you've helped us?
She won't find out, Veturius says, unless you plan on telling her, which I don't suggest. Come on, I'll take you back to your quarters. We slip up the cellar stairs and out to Blackcliff's funerally quiet grounds. I shiver, although the night's not cold. It's still dark, but the eastern sky pales and Veturius speeds his gait. As we hurry across the grass, I stumble, and he is beside me, steadying me, his warmth seeping into my skin. "All right?" he asks. My feet ache, my head pounds, and the Commandant's mark burns like fire. But more powerful is the tingling enveloping my entire body at the mask's closeness. Danger! My skin seems to scream. He's dangerous. Fine, I jerk away from him. I'm fine. As we walk, I sneak glances at him, with his mask on and the walls of Blackcliff rising around him. Veturius is every inch the martial soldier. Yet I can't reconcile the image before me with the handsome tribesman I dance with. All that time, he knew who I was. He knew I was lying about my family, and though it's ridiculous to care what a mask thinks, I feel suddenly ashamed of those lies. We reach the servants' corridor, and Izzy breaks away from us. Thank you, she says to Veturius. Guilt washes over me. She'll never forgive me after what she's been through. Izzy, I touch her arm. I'm sorry. If I'd known about the raid, I'd never... Are you joking? Izzy says. Her eye darts to Veturius, standing behind me. And she smiles, a blaze of white that startles me with its beauty. I wouldn't have traded this for anything. Good night, Lyra. I stare at her, open-mouthed, as she disappears down the hallway and into her room. Veturius clears his throat. He's watching me with a strange, almost apologetic expression in his eyes. I have something for you. He pulls a bottle from his pocket. Sorry I didn't get it to you earlier. I was indisposed. I take the bottle, and when our fingers touch, I pull away quickly. It's the blood root serum. I'm surprised he remembered. I'll just thank you, I say at the same time. We both fall silent. Veturius rubs a hand through his hair, but a second later, his entire body goes still. A deer that's heard the hunter. What? I gasp when his arms come around me, sudden and hard. He pushes me to the wall, heat flaring from his hands and tingling across my skin, sending my heart into a feverish beat. My own reaction to him, confusion tumbled with head-spinning want, shocks me into silence. What is wrong with you, Lyra? Then his hands tighten on my back as if in warning, and he dips his head low to my ear, his breath a bare whisper. Do what I tell you, when I tell you, or you're dead. I knew it. How could I have trusted him? Stupid, so stupid. Push me away, he says. Fight me. I shove at him, not needing his encouragement. Get away from... Don't be like that. His voice is louder now, sleek and menacing, and devoid of anything resembling decency. You didn't mind before. Leave her, soldier, a bored, wintry voice says. My blood goes cold, and I twist away from Veturius. There, detaching from the kitchen door like a wraith, stands the Commandant. How long has she been watching us? Why is she even awake? The Commandant steps into the corridor and surveys me dispassionately, ignoring Veturius. So, that's where you'd got to. Her pale hair is loose around her shoulders, her robe pulled tight. I just came down, rang the bell for water 5 minutes ago. I suppose it was only a matter of time. You are a pretty thing. She doesn't reach for her crop or threaten to kill me. She doesn't even seem angry, just irritated. Soldier, she says, back to the barracks with you. You've had her for long enough. Commandant, sir. Veturius breaks away from me with seeming reluctance. I try to squirm away from him, but he keeps a proprietary arm slung around my hips. You sent her to her quarters for the night. I assumed you were done with her. Veturius, The Commandant, I realize, hadn't recognized him in the dark. She hadn't cared enough to give him a second look. Her eyes shift to her son in disbelief. You, and a slave. I was bored, he shrugs. I've been stuck in the infirmary for days. My face goes hot. I understand now why he put his hands on me, why he told me to fight him. He is trying to protect me from the Commandant. He must have sensed her presence. She will have no way of proving I haven't spent the last few hours with Veturius, and since students rape slaves all the time, neither he nor I will be punished. But it's still humiliating. You expect me to believe you? The Commandant cocks her head. She senses the lie. She smells it. You've never touched a slave in your life. With all due respect, sir, that's because the first thing you do when you get a new slave is take her eye out. Veturius tangles his fingers in my hair, and I yelp. Or carve up her face. But this one... He yanks my head toward his, a warning in his eyes when he glances down at me. Is still intact. Mostly. Please. I drop my voice. If this is going to work, I need to play along, disgusting as it is. Tell him to leave me alone. Get out, Veturius. The Commandant's eyes glitter. Next time, find a kitchen drudge to entertain you. The girl is mine. Veturius gives his mother a short salute before releasing me and sauntering through the gate without so much as a backward glance. The Commandant looks me over, as if for signs of what she thinks just happened. She jerks my chin up. I pinch myself on the leg hard enough to draw blood, and my eyes fill with tears. Would it have been better if I'd cut your face, like Cook's? She murmurs. Beauty's a curse when one lives among men. You might have thanked me for it. She runs a fingernail across my cheek, and I shudder. Well, she lets me go and walks back to the kitchen door with a smile, a twist of her mouth that is all bitterness and no mirth. The spirals of her strange tattoo catch the moonlight. There's time yet for that.
Chapter 30 Elias. For 3 days after the moon festival, Helene avoids me. She ignores knocks on her door, leaves the mess hall when I appear, and begs off when I approach her head-on. When we're paired together in training, she attacks me as if I'm Marcus. When I speak to her, she goes suddenly deaf. I let it go at first, but by the third day, I'm sick of it. On my way to combat training, I'm concocting a plan to confront her, something involving a chair and rope, and maybe a gag, so she has no choice but to listen to me. When Kane appears beside me, as suddenly as a ghost. My sim is half-drawn before I realize who it is.
Skies, Kane! Don't do that. Greetings, Aspirant Veturius. Wonderful weather.
The Augur looks up at the hot blue sky admiringly. Yeah, if you're not training with double sims under the baking sun, I mutter. It's not even noon, and I'm so covered in sweat that I've given up and taken off my shirt. If Helene was speaking to me, she'd frown and say it's not regulation. I'm too hot to care.
You are healed from the second trial?
Kane asks. No thanks to you. The words are out before I can stop them, but I don't feel particularly regretful. Multiple attempts on my life have taken a toll on my manners.
The trials are not meant to be easy, Elias. That is why they are called the trials.
I hadn't noticed. I speed up, hoping Kane will piss off. He doesn't.
I bring you a message, he says. The next trial will take place in 7 days.
At least we get some warning this time. What's it going to be? I ask. Public flogging? A knight locked in a trunk with 100 vipers?
Combat against a formidable foe, Cain says. Nothing you can't handle.
What foe? What's the catch?
No way the Augur will tell me what I'm up against without leaving something essential out.
It's going to be a sea of wraiths we're fighting, or djinn, or some other beastie they've woken from the darkness.
We haven't woken anything from the darkness that wasn't already awake,
Cain says. I bite back a response. If he picks my mind again, I swear I'll shove this blade through him, Augur or not.
It wouldn't do any good, Elias.
He smiles, almost sadly, then nods to the field, where Hel is training.
I ask that you pass the message along to Aspirant Aquila.
As Aquila isn't speaking with me, that might be a bit difficult.
I'm sure you'll find a way.
He drifts off, leaving me more ill-tempered than before. When Hel and I argue, we usually patch things up in a few hours, a day at most. 3 days is a record for us. Worse, I've never seen her lose her temper the way she did 3 nights ago. Even in battle, she is always cool, controlled. But she's been different the past few weeks. I've known it, though like a fool I've tried not to see it. But I can't ignore her behavior anymore. It has to do with that spark between us, that attraction. Either we crush it, or we do something about it. And I'm thinking that while the latter might be more enjoyable, it will create complications neither of us needs. When did Helene change? She has always been in control of every emotion, every desire. She's never shown interest in any of her comrades, and other than Leander, none of us is stupid enough to try to start anything with her. So what happened between us that changed things? I think back to the first time I noticed her acting strange, the morning she found me in the catacombs. I'd tried to distract her by leering. I'd done it without thinking, hoping to keep her from finding my pack. I figured she'd just think it was me being male. Is that what did it? That one look? Has she been acting so strangely because she thinks I want her, and so she feels like she has to want me back? If that's the case, then I need to clear things up with her straight away. I'll tell her that it was a fluke, that I didn't mean anything by it. Will she accept my apology? Only if you grovel enough. Fine. It will be worth it. If I want my freedom, I have to win the next trial. In the first two, Hel and I depended on each other for survival. The third will probably be the same. I need her on my side. I find Hel on the combat field sparring with Tristus, while a combat centurion looks on. The boys and I tease Tristus for constantly mooning over his fiancée, but he's one of the finest swordsmen at Blackcliff, clever and cat-swift. He waits for Helene to slip up, taking note of the aggression in her strokes. But her defense is as impenetrable as the walls of Koff. Minutes after I arrive at the field, she's thrown off Tristus's attack and jabbed his heart.
"Greetings, O holy aspirant!"
Tristus calls out when he sees me. At Helene's stiffening shoulders, he glances between us and makes a quick departure. Along with Faris and Dex, Tristus has tried repeatedly to figure out what went wrong between Helene and me on the night of the party, which neither of us attended. But Hel's been as silent as I have, and they've given up, instead grunting to one another pointedly when she and I beat each other down on the battlefield.
Aquila!
I call to her as she sheaths her sims.
I need to talk to you!
Silence. Fine, then.
Cain said to tell you the next trial is in 7 days.
I head to the armory.
unsurprised when I hear her footsteps trailing.
Well, what is it?
She grabs my shoulder and pulls me around.
What's the trial?
Her face is flushed and her eyes flash. Skies, she's pretty when she's angry. The thought surprises me, accompanied as it is by a pulse of fierce desire. It's Helene, Elias. Helene.
Combat, I say. We'll be up against a formidable foe.
Right,
she says.
Good.
But she doesn't move, only glares at me, unaware that the tendrils of hair that have escaped her braid make the glare much less intimidating than she'd like.
Hell, look, I know you're mad, but...
Oh, go put on a shirt.
She stalks away, muttering about twits who flaunt regulation. I stifle an angry retort. Why is she so damn stubborn? As I enter the armory, I run straight into Marcus, who shoves me into the doorframe. For once, Zack's not with him.
Your whore's still not talking to you,
he says.
Not spending time with you either, is she?
Avoiding you. Avoiding the other boys.
Alone.
He looks speculatively at Helene's retreating back, and I go for my sim, but Marcus is already holding a dagger to my stomach.
She belongs to me, you know. I dreamt it.
His calmness chills me more than any boasting could.
One of these days, I'll find her, and you won't be around, he says. And I'll make her mine.
You stay away from her. Anything happens to her, I'll slit you open from your neck to your sorry.
It's always threats with you,
Marcus says.
You never actually do anything. Not surprising for a traitor whose mask hasn't even melded yet.
He leans forward. The mask knows you're weak, Elias.
It knows you don't belong. That's why it's still not a part of you. That's why I should kill you.
His dagger cuts into my stomach, releasing a trickle of blood. One thrust, one pull upward, and he could gut me like a fish. I shake with anger. I'm at his mercy, and I hate him for it.
But the centurions are watching.
Marcus's gaze flicks to our left, where the combat centurion is fast approaching.
And I'd rather kill you slow.
He strolls away lazily, saluting the combat centurion as he passes. Furious with myself, with Helene, with Marcus, I shove open the armory door and go straight to the heavy weaponry rack, settling on a tri-flanged mace. I swing it through the air and pretend I'm taking off Marcus's head. When I get back out to the field, the combat centurion pairs me with Helene. My rage spills out of me, tainting every move. Helene, on the other hand, channels her fury into a steely efficiency. She sends my mace flying, and only a few minutes later, I'm forced to yield. Disgusted, she stalks away to battle her next opponent, while I'm still scrambling to my feet. From the other side of the field, I see Marcus watching. Not me, but her. His eyes gleaming, his fingers caressing a dagger. Varys gives me a hand up, and I call Dex and Tristis over, grimacing at the bruises Helene's gifted me.
Is Aquila still avoiding you?
Dex nods.
Like the porks?
Keep an eye on her anyway, I say. Even if she wants you to stay away. Marcus knows she's avoiding us. It's only a matter of time before he decides to attack.
You do know that she'll kill us if she catches us playing guard dog, Varys says.
Which do you prefer, I say, angry Helene or beaten Helene? Varys goes pale, but he and Dex vow to keep an eye on her, glaring at Marcus as they leave the field.
Elias?
Tristis lingers, looking alarmingly awkward.
If you like, we can discuss...
He scratches his tattoo.
Well, it's just I've had some ups and downs with Aelia. So with Helene, if you want to talk about it...
Ah, right.
Helene and I aren't... We're just friends.
Trista sighs.
You know she's in love with you, right?
She's not. No. I can't seem to make my mouth work, so I just close it and look at him in mute appeal. Any second, he's going to grin and slap me on the back. He's going to say,
Just kidding! Ah, Vittorius, the look on your face!
Any second.
Trust me,
Trista says.
I have four older sisters, and I'm the only one of the guys who's been in a relationship that's lasted longer than a month. I can see it every time she looks at you. She's in love with you. She has been for a while.
But she's Helene, I say stupidly.
I mean, come on, we've all thought about Helene.
Trista nods gamely. But she doesn't think of us. She's seen us at our worst. I think of the trial of courage, of my sobs when I realized that she was real and not a hallucination.
Why would she...
Who knows, Elias? Trista says.
She can kill a man with a twist of her hand. She's a demon with a sword, and she can drink most of us under the table. And because of all that, maybe we've forgotten that she's a girl.
I have not forgotten that Helene's a girl.
I'm not talking about physically. I'm talking about in her head. Girls think about things like this differently than we do. She's in love with you, and whatever happened between you two is because of it. I promise you.
It's not true. My head tells me with the zeal of denial.
Just lust, not love.
Shut it, head, my heart says. I know Helene like I know fighting, like I know killing. I know the smell of her fear and the rawness of blood against her skin. I know that she flares her nostrils very slightly when she lies, and that she puts her hands between her knees when she sleeps. I know the beautiful parts, the ugly parts. Her anger at me is from a deep place, a dark place, a place she doesn't admit she has. The day I looked at her so thoughtlessly, I made her think that maybe I had that place too, that maybe she wasn't alone in that place.
She's my best friend, I say to Tristus. I can't go down that road with her.
No, you can't. There's sympathy in Tristus's eyes. He knows what she means to me.
And that's the problem.
Chapter 31 Liar. My sleep is fitful and scanty, haunted by the Commandant's threat. Time enough for that yet. When I wake before dawn, scraps of nightmare stay with me, my face carved and branded, my brother hanging from the gallows, fair hair fluttering in the wind. Think of something else. I close my eyes and see Keenan, remembering how he asked me to dance. So shy and unlike himself. That fire in his eyes as he spun me around. I thought it must mean something, but he left so abruptly. Is he all right? Did he escape the raid? Did he hear Vittorius shout out the warning? Vittorius. I hear his laugh and smell the spice of his body, and I have to force those sensations away and replace them with the truth. He's a mask. He's the enemy. Why did he help me? He risked imprisonment by doing so. Worse than that, if rumors about the Black Guard and their purges are true, I can't believe he did it solely for my benefit. A lark, then? Some sick martial game I don't yet understand? Don't stick around to find out, liar, Darin whispers in my head. Get me out of here. Footsteps shuffle in the kitchen, cook making breakfast. If the old woman is up, Izzy won't be far behind. I dress quickly, hoping to get to her before cook sets us to our daily drudgery. Izzy will know of a secret entrance to the school. But Izzy, it turns out, left early on an errand for cook. She won't be back until noon, cook informs me. Not that it's your concern. The old woman points to a black folio on the table. Commandant says you're to take that folio to Spiro Tullaman first thing, before attending to your other duties. I stifle a groan. I'll just have to wait to talk to Izzy. When I get to Tullaman's shop, I'm surprised to see the door open, the forge fire burning. Sweat streams down the smith's face and into his burn-scarred jerkin as he hammers at a glowing chunk of steel. Beside him stands a tribal girl clad in sheer, rose-coloured robes, their hems embroidered with tiny round mirrors. The girl is murmuring something I can't hear over the ringing of the hammer. Tullaman nods a greeting at me but continues his conversation with the girl. As I watch them speak, I realize she's older than I first thought, perhaps in her mid-twenties. Her silky black hair, shot through with fiery red, is woven into thin, intricate braids, and her dainty face is vaguely familiar. Then I recognize her. She danced with Veturius at the Moon Festival. She shakes Tullaman's hand, offers him a sack of coins, and then makes her way out the forge's back door with an appraising glance in my direction. Her eyes linger on my slave's cuffs, and I look away. Her name's Afia Arana, Spiro Tullaman says when the woman is gone. She's the only female chieftain among the tribes, one of the most dangerous women you'll ever meet. Also one of the cleverest. Her tribe carries weapons to the Marin branch of the Scholar's Resistance. Why are you telling me this? What's wrong with him? That's the type of knowledge that will get me killed. Spiro shrugs. Your brother made most of the weapons she's taking. I thought you'd want to know where they're going. No, I don't want to know. Why doesn't he understand? I want nothing to do with whatever it is you're doing. All I want is for things to go back to the way they were. Before you made my brother your apprentice, before the Empire took him because of it. You might as well wish away that scar. Tullaman nods to where my cloak has fallen open, revealing the Commandant's K. Hastily, I pull the garment closed. Things will never go back to the way they were. He flips the metal he's shaping with a pair of tongs and continues hammering. If the Empire freed Darin tomorrow, he'd come here and start making weapons again. His destiny is to rise, to help his people overthrow their oppressors, and mine is to help him do it. I'm so angry at Tullaman's presumption that I don't think before I speak. So now you're the savior of the scholars, after spending years creating the weapons that have destroyed us. I live with my sins every day. He throws down the tongs and turns to me. I live with the guilt. But there are two kinds of guilt, girl. The kind that drowns you until you're useless, and the kind that fires your soul to purpose. The day I made my last weapon for the Empire, I drew a line in my mind. I'd never make a martial blade again. I'd never have scholar blood on my hands again. I won't cross that line. I'll die before I cross it. His hammer is clenched in his hand like a weapon, his hard, angled face lit with tightly controlled fervor. So this is why Darin agreed to be his apprentice. There's something of our mother in this man's ferocity, something of our father in the way he carries himself. His passion is true and contagious. When he speaks, I want to believe. He opens his hand. You have a message. I give him the folio. You said you'd die before you crossed that line, and yet you're making a weapon for the Commandant. No. Spiro peruses the folio. I'm pretending to make a weapon for her, so she'll keep sending you with messages. As long as she thinks my interest in you will get her a Tullaman blade,
She won't do you any irreparable harm. I might even be able to persuade her to sell you to me. Then I'll break those damn things off. He nods to my cuffs. And set you free. At my surprise, Spiro looks away, as if embarrassed. It's the least I can do for your brother. He's going to be executed, I whisper. In a week. Executed? Spiro says. Not possible. He'd still be in Central Prison if he was to be executed. And he was moved from there. Where? I don't yet know. Tullamon's eyes narrow. How did you learn he was to be executed? Who have you been talking to?
I don't answer. Darren might have trusted the Smith, but I can't bring myself to. Maybe Tullamon really is a revolutionary. Or maybe he's a very convincing spy. I have to go, I say. Cook's expecting me back.
Liar, wait.
I don't hear the rest. I'm already out the door. As I walk back to Blackcliff, I try to push his words from my head. But I can't. Darren's been moved. When? Where? Why didn't Mazin mention it? How is my brother? Is he suffering? What if the marshals have broken his bones? Skies his fingers. What if... No more. Nan once said that there's hope in life. If Darren's alive, nothing else matters. If I can get him out, the rest can be fixed. My path back takes me through Execution Square, where the gibbets are conspicuously empty. No one has been hung for days. Keenan said the marshals are saving the executions for the new emperor. Marcus and his brother will enjoy such a spectacle. What if one of the others wins? Would Aquila smile as innocent men and women twist at the end of a rope? Would Veturius? Ahead of me, the crowd slows to a standstill as a tribal caravan 20 wagons long ambles across the square. I turn to go around it, but everyone else has the same idea, resulting in a mess of swearing, shoving, mired bodies. And then, amid the chaos, you're all right. I recognize his voice instantly. He wears a tribal vest, but even with the hood up, his hair trickles out like a tongue of flame. After the raid, Keenan says, I wasn't sure. I've been watching the square all day, hoping you'd come through.
You got out too.
All of us did, just in time. The marshals took more than 100 scholars last night. He cocks his head. Your friend escaped?
If I say Izzy's all right, I'm as good as admitting that I brought her with me to an information drop. Keenan regards me with his unflinching stare. He'll know a lie a mile away.
Yes, I say. She escaped. She knows you're a spy.
She's helped me. I know I shouldn't have let her, but...
But it just happened. Your brother's life is at risk here, liar. I understand.
A fight breaks out behind us, and Keenan rests a hand on my back, turning me so he's between me and the flying punches.
Mazin said a meeting 8 days from now, in the morning. 10th bell. Come here to the square. If you need to meet before, wear a grey scarf over your hair and wait on the south side of the square. Someone will be watching for you.
Keenan, I think of what Tullamon said about Darren. Are you sure my brother's in Central Prison? That he's to be executed? I heard he's been moved.
Our spies are reliable, Keenan says. Mazin would know if he'd been transferred.
My neck prickles. Something's not right. What aren't you telling me? Keenan rubs a stubble on his face, and my unease swells.
It's nothing you need to worry about, liar.
10 hells! I turn his face toward me, forcing him to meet my eyes. If it affects Darren, I say, I need to worry about it. Is it Mazin? Has he changed his mind?
No. Keenan's tone does little to reassure me. I don't think so. But he's been... strange. Quiet about this mission. Hiding the spy reports.
I try to justify this. Perhaps Mazin is worried the mission will be compromised.
When I say as much, Keenan shakes his head. It's not just that, he says. I can't confirm it, but I think he's planning something else. Something big. Something that doesn't involve Darin. But how can we save Darin and take on another mission? We don't have enough men. Ask him, I say. You're his second. He trusts you. Ugh, Keenan grimaces. Not exactly. Has he fallen out of favor? I don't get a chance to ask. Ahead of us, the caravan lurches out of the way, and the pent-up crowd surges forward. In the crush, my cloak rips free. Keenan's eyes drop to the scar. It's so prominent, so red and hideous, I think miserably. How could he not look? 10 bleeding hells, what happened? The Commandant punished me a few days ago. I didn't know, liar. All his aloofness dissolves as he stares at the scar. Why didn't you tell me? Would you have cared? His eyes jerk to mine, surprised. Anyway, it's nothing compared to what it could have been. She took Izzy's eye, and you should see what she did to Cook. Her entire face. I shudder. I know it's ugly. Horrible. No, he says the word like it's an order. Don't think that. It means you survived her. It means you're brave. The crowd moves around me, past me. People elbow and mutter at us. But then it all fades because Keenan has taken my hand and is looking from my eyes to my lips and back up in a way that needs no translation. I notice a freckle, perfect and round, at the corner of his mouth. A slow warmth uncurls low in my body as he pulls me to him. Then a leather-clad mariner shoves past, breaking us apart, and Keenan's mouth twitches in a brief, rueful smile. He squeezes my hand once. I'll see you soon. He melts into the crowd, and I hurry back toward Blackcliff. If Izzy knows of an entrance, I still have time to see it for myself and head back here to pass along the information. The Resistance can get Darin out, and I'll be done with all of this. No more scars or whippings, no more terror and fear. And maybe, a quiet part of me whispers, I'll get more than just a few moments with Keenan. I find Izzy in the back courtyard, scrubbing sheets beside the water pump. I only know of the hidden trail, liar, Izzy says to my question. And even that's not secret, just so dangerous that most people don't use it. I vigorously crank water from the pump, using the squeal of metal to drown out our voices. Izzy's mistaken. She has to be. What about the tunnels? Or do you think one of the other slaves will know something? You saw how it was last night. We only got through the tunnels because of Veturius. As for the other slaves, it's risky. Some of them spy for the Commandant. No, no, no. What just minutes ago seemed like a wealth of time, 8 whole days, is no time at all. Izzy hands me a freshly washed sheet, and I hang it on the line with impatient hands. A map, then. There must be a map to this place somewhere. At this, Izzy brightens. Maybe, she says. In the Commandant's office. The only place you'll find a map of Blackcliff, a raspy voice intrudes, is in the Commandant's head. And I don't think you want to go rummaging around in there. I gape like a fish as Cook, as silent-footed as her mistress, materializes from behind the sheet I've just hung up. Izzy jumps at Cook's sudden appearance, but then, to my shock, she stands and crosses her arms. There must be something, she says to the old woman. How'd she get the map in her head? She must have a point of reference. When she became Commandant, Cook says, the Augurs gave her a map to memorize and burn. That's how it's always been done at Blackcliff. At the surprise on my face, she snorts. When I was younger and even stupider than you, I kept my eyes and ears open. Now my head's filled with useless knowledge that does no one any good. But it's not useless, I say. You must know of a secret way into the school. I don't. The scars on Cook's face are livid against her skin. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you. My brother's in Central's death cells. He's going to be executed in days, and if I don't find a secret way into Blackcliff... Let me ask you a question, girl, Cook says. It's the Resistance who says your brother's in prison. The Resistance who says he's going to be executed, right? But how do they know? And how do you know they're telling the truth? Your brother might be dead. Even if he is in Central's death cells, the Resistance will never get him out. A blind, deaf stone could tell you that. If he was dead, they'd have told me. Why can't she just help me? I trust them, all right? I have to trust them. Besides, Mazin says he has a plan. Bah! Cook sneers. The next time you see this Mazin, you ask him where exactly your brother is in Central. What cell? You ask him how he knows and who his spies are. Ask him how having an entrance to Blackcliff will help him break into the most fortified prison in the South. After he answers, we'll see if you still trust the bastard. Cook, Izzy speaks up, but the old woman whirls on her. Don't you start. You've got no idea what you're getting into. The only reason I haven't turned her into the Commandant, Cook practically spits at me, is because of you. As it is, I can't trust that slave girl, won't give up your name to make the Commandant go easy on her. Izzy, I'd look to my friend. No matter what the Commandant did, I would never... You think that carving on your heart makes you an expert in pain, Cook says. Ever been tortured, girl? Ever been tied to a table while hot coals burned into your throat? Ever had your face carved up with a dull knife while a mask poured salt water into your wounds? I stare at her stonily. She knows the answer. You can't know if you'd betray Izzy, Cook says, because you've never had your limits tested. The Commandant was trained at Koff. If she interrogated you, you betray your own mother. My mother's dead, I say, and thank the skies for it. Who knows what damage she and her rebels would have caused if she still lived. I look at Cook, askance. Again, the stutter. Again, when she's speaking of the Resistance. Cook, Izzy stands eye to eye with the old woman, though she somehow seems taller. Please help her. I've never asked you for anything. I'm asking you now. What's your stake in it? Cook's mouth twists like she's tasted something sour. Did she promise to get you out? To save you? Stupid girl. Resistance never saves anyone they can leave behind. She didn't promise me anything, Izzy says. I want to help her because she's my friend. I'm your friend, Cook's dark eyes say. I wonder for the 100th time who this woman is and what the Resistance and my mother did to her that she would hate and mistrust them so much. I just want to save Darren, I say. I just want out of here. Everyone wants out of here, girl. I want out. Izzy wants out. Even the damn students want out. If you want to leave so badly, I suggest you go to your precious Resistance and ask for another mission. Somewhere where you won't get yourself killed. She stalks away, and I should be angry, but instead I'm repeating what she said in my head. Even the damn students want out. Even the damn students want out. Izzy, I turn to my friend. I think I know how to find a way out of Blackcliff. Hours later, as I crouch behind a hedge outside Blackcliff's barracks, I'm wondering if I've made a mistake. The curfew drums thud and fall silent. I've been sitting here for an hour with roots and rocks digging into my knees. Not a single student has emerged from the barracks. But at some point, one will. As Cook said, even the students want out of Blackcliff. They must sneak out How else would they manage their drinking and whoring? Some must bribe the gate guards or tunnel guards. But surely there's another way out of here. I fidget and shift, exchanging one prickly branch for another. I can't lurk in the shadow of this squat shrub for much longer. Izzy is covering for me, but if the Commandant calls and I don't appear, I'll be punished. Worse, Izzy might be punished. Did she promise to get you out? To save you? I promised Izzy no such thing. But I should. Now that Cook's brought it up, I can't stop thinking about it. What will happen to Izzy when I'm gone? The Resistance said they'd make my sudden disappearance from Blackcliff look like suicide. But the Commandant will question Izzy anyway. The woman's not easily fooled. I can't just leave Izzy here to face interrogation. She's the first true friend I've had since Zara. But how can I get the Resistance to shelter her? If it hadn't been for Sunna, they wouldn't have even helped me. There must be a way. I could bring Izzy with me when I leave this place. The Resistance wouldn't be so heartless as to send her back, not if they knew what would happen to her. As I consider, I set my sights back on the buildings before me, just in time to see two figures emerge from the Skull's barracks. Light glints off the lighter hair of one, and I recognize the prowling gait of the other. Marcus and Zack. The twins turn away from the front gates and pass by the tunnel grates closest to the barracks, instead heading for one of the training buildings. I follow them, close enough to hear them speak, but far enough that they won't notice me. Who knows what they'd do if they caught me trailing them?
"Can't stand this," a voice drifts back to me. "I feel like he's taking over my mind." "Stop being such a damned girl," Marcus replies. "He teaches us what we need to avoid the Augur's mind-leeching. You should be grateful."
I edge closer, interested despite myself. Could they be speaking of the creature from the Commandant's study?
"Every time I look into his eyes," Zack says, "I see my own death. At least you'll be prepared." "No," Zack says quietly. "I don't think so."
Marcus grunts in irritation.
"I don't like it any better than you do. But we have to win this thing. So man up."
They enter the training building, and I grab the heavy oak door just before it shuts, watching them through the crack. Blue fire lanterns dimly light the hall, and their footsteps echo between the pillars on either side. Just before the building curves, they disappear behind one of the columns. Stone grates against stone, and all goes silent. I enter the building and listen. The hallway is quiet as a tomb, but that doesn't mean the Farahs are gone. I make my way to the pillar where they disappeared, expecting to see a training room door. But there's nothing there. Only stone. I move on to the next room. Empty. The next. Empty. Moonlight from the windows tinges every room a ghostly blue-white, and they are, all of them, empty. The Farahs have disappeared. But how? A secret entrance. I'm certain of it. Giddy relief floods me. I found it. Found what Mazin wants. Not yet, liar. I still have